following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
I'm with Steve Clements. He was a moderator at the two of the great panels at the Doha Forum in the Middle East. We were with him a bunch of days last week, flew back together on the plane. I think it took me, Steve, to get back from Doha to Norfolk, Virginia. It took me from the time I actually got in the car at the hotel, 22 out of 24 hours traveling to get back with the time change. Steve, I know you got a little jet lag. Great to have you with us, man.
You know, what's great with jet lag, I almost have you beat because I actually landed in Philadelphia with you, and then I rented a car, drove to New York for a Christmas party, and drove back to Philadelphia last night just to keep myself awake so I would get back in our zone. I just have one thing to mention. I didn't title that book. Trust me, I'm an expert. I hate the title of that book. Somebody else titled it, so totally with you on that.
Oh, my good. All right, well, it's it's a good title, though.
Steve, yeah, no, I mean, it's not a good title.
Know, why
it's not a good
expert.
Title. It's Steve is a, but anyway, it was fun traveling with you, and honestly, you and your wife were just a breath of fresh air there. You know, there's a lot of people that, you know, I think are kind of full of themselves. These things are diva contests in many ways. But, I mean, the forum was fascinating, but I love how engaged you were through all the sessions, and I just want to compliment you on that.
Well, thank you, Steve. That's very nice of you to say. I really appreciate that. And, of course, you were the moderator on two of them. But what was interesting about this is there were about 3,000 people there from around the world. I think 70 people were represented. This was at the Doha Forum, their 18th, and 70 people from the United States. But just to, as a tidbit aside on what you said, there was a lot of people there that were enamored with the trip. Like, it was all about the trip there and not the conference, and it's just not U.S. people. But they were like, you know, it was all about, like, what plane did you fly on and how big was, and did you have this, were you first class? And so it was all about the trip, and then, and, you know, half of them didn't even show up at some of the conferences. I didn't miss any of them. And some of them I want to go over because, you know, you learn, Steve, you learn so much. The two that you moderated, I'm going to get into that in a minute. But I want to share with your audience a couple of the really cool ones. Like, there was an interview that Barbara Robin did. You'll have to say her last name. I forgot it. With the Iranian foreign minister. Which, I mean, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, there was like, I don't know, 2,500, 3,000 people in this huge auditorium, everything on screen. So you got the Iranian foreign minister getting into it. That was a great interview.
And just, there
was no holds barred, right?
Yeah, no holds barred.
Go ahead.
She was stuff on him. And you know, Robin, who is writes a lot for The New Yorker magazine now, she used to be one of the lead international correspondents for many years for The Washington Post, and is really one of the country's best experts on the Middle East, and particularly Iran. And she's been, you know, tough on Javad Zarif, who's the foreign minister. He was previously Iran's ambassador to United Nations. But when Ahmadinejad was president of Iran, Javad Zarif was in disfavor, and he sort of disappeared for a while. Like, he was not, you know, when
really?
You see the winners and losers in Iranian politics from afar, the guy we saw in Doha used to be someone whose life was in danger, and he's considered to be part, if you can consider any part of Iran, the reform community. He's the reform community. I'm always careful of telling people there are no white hats and black hats. They're all kind of dark shades of gray everywhere. But you know, it was a fascinating exchange, and you saw one of the great performances, I think, in foreign affairs in her interview with him.
Well, and then his responses were classic. Now, and here's what I learned from that, two things. One, and I just want to get your comment. The mm-hmm. first thing I learned is Robin said to him, well, you know, Mr. Foreign Minister, there's unrest in your country. Your people are unhappy. Your regime might not survive. I'm paraphrasing the question, but that was the gist of it. And his answer was, look, you've been telling us this for 40 years. And he said, we have survived for 40 years. You know, we have no umbrella security. We have no NATO. We have nobody that backs us. You know, everything we have is loose, and Saddam Hussein rolled his tanks in towards Tehran. Everybody in the West backed him, Robin, including you and everybody else. Nobody backed us. Nobody gave us a chance. And here we are under constant pressure from the United States 40 years later, still standing. So I think as far as our people is concerned, we're in pretty good shape. But that was a great answer.
It was a great answer, you know, and I've thought a lot about it since he answered it. And, you know, I find Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, very, very interesting. But what he didn't, what Robin didn't say in response was that if she were interviewing Kim Jong-un of North Korea, he could say the same thing. And so Javad Zarif was trying to argue that their country, which has no backstop, that has, you know, America that has been at odds with it for all of this time, that he was trying to say that they could not have survived, that they did not have the robust support of their own people, because she was asking him, what about Iran's human rights abuses? What about the terrible things it has done? Because she was saying, you know, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and these implications that he directed the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and Javad kind of went off on that and said, you know, it's typical of this murderous regime, et cetera, and then shared that. But he said, you know, if you use fear, harassment, and all sorts of control techniques, as you see in North Korea, you can also stay in power for many, many decades without the support of your people. And that would have been the response I would have offered to take it one step further.
Right. That would have been the definite follow-up question. You're on the John Fredericks Radio Network, Truck the Truth Across America. I'm with Steve Clements. He was a key moderator in two very influential panels at the 18th Doha conference that just concluded this weekend in Qatar. And Steve is also the Washington editor at large for The Atlantic, and he's also editor of The Atlantic Live. He writes frequently about Middle East politics and foreign affairs. Also, now let's get to, and you can do the names better than me. Let's get to the chief Palestinian. The chief. This was another class.
Isn't he something?
I don't do this justice on the radio. Yeah. You just had to be there, and it's just one interviewer, an Erekat, who's, you know, in leadership in the Palestinian government, chief negotiator, and it's just freewheeling. I mean, there's no boundaries, and there's, you know, 3,000 people in there, and he's just going off. He went off for 30 minutes, but tell him about the fight he had in the White House with Jared Kushner. That was a classic.
Well, what, you know, Saeb Erekat has been for many, many decades, and I'm not joking about the word decades, the lead negotiator for the Palestinians with the Israelis and the rest of the world. On trying to negotiate a settlement, and so he's been there in the system forever. And the gentleman that was trying to interview him but could hardly get a word in edgeways was Rob Malley, who's president of the International Crisis Group and used to be in Obama's White House on the National Security Council team. And literally, Saeb shut him out. But what Saeb conveyed is, I think he wanted to convey a feistiness and a resilience to pressure that he confessed that they had a major blow up, a screaming, yelling match with Jared Kushner, who is of course President Trump's designee, along with Jonathan Greenblatt, to try to work out a broad deal, you know, what some have called the deal of the century in the Middle East on a Palestinian two-state solution or something that would approximate that in the region, and we had never heard of this blow up between them that apparently was a screaming match.
Yeah. And in part of it, I guess he said he told Jared Kushner in the White House, he said, well, if you move the embassy, the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, there will never be a peace treaty. It just is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And he said that Kushner screamed at him, don't threaten me. So I thought that was a good tidbit of info, but boy, there was no compromise there. I mean, I got out of that, and when it ended, and I said to myself, there's no peace plan. There's no grand plan. There's no anything, because he said.
Well, I would disagree respectfully in the sense, I mean, from Saeb Erekat's viewpoint, there's no peace plan. And, you know, many of us have been watching the Middle East also agreed with Saeb that moving our designated capital before you had a kind of broader arrangement sort of took out one of the legs of a potential peace deal and removed our leverage. But, you know, take it as it is. That's where we are now, and so you need to work with that. And what the Palestinians have been unwilling to do you know, is to do anything else, and it's made them largely irrelevant to the peace deal. But where I kind of disagree, and this is why the Jamal Khashoggi thing, which is also kind of a discussion that reverberated, is that Jared Kushner believed that he could do a deal with the Saudis backstopping a deal no matter what the Palestinians wanted. So you could kind of jump over the Palestinians, jump over Saeb Erekat, work out a deal in an arrangement that brought together all the major stakeholders, Arab states in the region behind it, and kind of force the Palestinians to accept that. But now Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, is definitely handicapped, definitely weakened in significant ways inside his country, within the region, with the implications of the Jamal Khashoggi murder. And so that has real, I mean, putting all of his eggs in one basket, meaning Jared Kushner with Mohammed bin Salman on this, has really then upended the peace deal. And that's brought Saeb Erekat back in the news, you know, because you've brought, if you don't have Mohammed bin Salman able to deliver the region, then you've got to come back to the Palestinians. And it's kind of a seesaw.
What about, one of the questions came from the audience that said, was a really good question, was how can you have any negotiation or peace plan until you reconcile your own government with Hamas? Explain that to our audience, Steve Clemens.
Yeah, well, that question was, I think, an important one. Right now, you have a split government. You have Hamas in greater control in Gaza. You've also had, I mean, the last time that elections were held in Palestine, this was during the Bush administration, and you may remember Condoleezza Rice, George Bush, and everyone said, we want to see elections to proceed. And many of them were telling the Bush administration, including myself at the time, if you have elections, Hamas will win. What will you do? And the view from President Bush at that time is, we have to respect the electoral process. Well, sure enough, Hamas won. And they entered into, because Hamas knew, I mean, I think Hamas was surprised that it won, but Hamas ended up in a situation where they ended up having the prime minister, but they gave Fatah, the competing party, the presidency with Mahmoud Abbas, and they had a split government. That government eventually divided, and Hamas was essentially pushed out. It was a violent divide again. And so they have kind of an ongoing sort of simmering potential civil war in that country between two parties. And so the country remains deeply divided. Many are skeptical. There are some on the Fatah side that are very skeptical of Hamas. There are many Hamas followers that believe that, you know, Israel should be put out of its existence, though there are some Hamas followers that think they can come to some deal if they're given autonomy and the right of self-determination. So it's a confusing picture, but what is very clear and what this guy was trying to push, and Erekat literally exploded on stage, as you, I mean, it was an incredible moment in that, in the Doha Forum, is that he basically said, how can we deal with you if you can't deliver your government, if you can't deliver your people? And this has been the failure and weakness of the current president of Palestine, who's been unable, he's kind of gone into a hole. And he's kind of on a shrinking and shrinking island where the, you know, beaches are eroding away. And you're ending up not only with Hamas rising again in popularity, but very clearly a division that's unreconciled. And so it's very hard to figure out who to negotiate with on what terms. So the person's point was exactly right on target. And Erekat went crazy with it in response and just showed that he was, you know, in my view, largely irrelevant to the answer on the future of Palestine. To be honest,
I agree with that. And then I'm going to get to Joe Biden in a second, but I'm going to ask you one other part, get your take on it. Was, I forget the panel, but Brett McGurk was there, right? Special envoy to the president on ISIS. And, you know, I'm a Trump supporter, as you know. I was a Virginia chairman.
I respect that. I got about 97 out of 100 cousins that are Trump supporters, too, so I get it.
I know you said that in one of your panels.
Yeah.
I'm with the 97 and tell them that you talk to me, and I hope they all vote for me again in 2020. Plus, actually, I want to pick up the other three in your family. But what's interesting, McGurk said there was a question, and it might have come from the audience or the moderator. I don't remember. But the question was, what's the difference? What's been different from the Obama administration and the Trump administration? Because he served first George W., then he stayed with Obama, you know, which is rare in that kind of a job. But he stayed through now three administrations. And he said, well, you know, the Russians in Syria kind of knew what Obama was going to do. He wasn't going to do anything. On the other hand, He said Trump is unpredictable. They don't know what the hell he's going to do. In fact, he's used the military there two times in 24 months, so they don't really know what he's going to do. Therefore, they operate differently. Well, I thought that was tremendous insight.
Yeah. Steve. You know, Peter Bergen, my colleague, I actually hired Peter Bergen when I was at the New America Foundation. Peter is CNN's terrorism analyst, and Peter was the guy who found Osama bin Laden in 1997 when the CIA couldn't find him. And so he organized the first interview of bin Laden in 97, well before 9/11. And an interesting panel, Brett McGurk, of course, is the presidential envoy for coordinating allies on ISIS and the broad, you know, Middle East, North Africa, anywhere where ISIS has had a footprint, Brett McGurk has been involved. And I think Brett is right, and he said this before, that he saw the Obama administration as too timid, too cautious, and too predictable. And he sees Donald Trump as having injected a kind of backbone into some of the steps America was taking. It doesn't mean you want to be reckless, but it does mean that if you put a red line up and you say you're going to not allow chemical weapons, then you're going to take action on those. And I think McGurk was pleased that President Trump struck out. Now, I was critical of President Trump on those strikes because I called them polite strikes. They were too neat, too I would have liked to have a little more messiness. If we're going to strike, I want it to actually take out some of the Syrian power. But, you know, that's an argument. I wanted President Trump to be a little bit more messy, which many right. of my colleagues disagree with me. But I think that McGurk is right that there's been, at least in Syria, were more actions that really maintained, I think, the sense of American power there than people may realize. And I think that has helped him as a negotiator in some of that. So that was a very good revelation that he shared.
Yeah, it was good. You wanted a strike like Reagan did to Gaddafi when he put missiles inside his home and took out members of his family, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing
family,
that was.
But, you know, we didn't. I mean, we gave everybody sort of advance notice. These were 4 a.m. hits. Nobody was in the building, you know, and the airfield that we bombed was in operation again within 24 hours. That's a polite strike. It didn't disable the facilities. And we knew, you know, honestly, the thing that I'm really upset about is that we knew some of the sites where these chlorine gas production facilities are. And it is beyond me why we didn't bomb the hell out of them.
We're with Steve Clements. He is national editor for the magazine The Atlantic, also their Washington correspondent. Steve, I just got 1 minute. I'm running out of time, but you've covered Joe Biden a lot. And is Joe Biden going to run for president?
I have no idea, but I will tell you that if he doesn't, it will wreck him because every bit of DNA in his body sees it as unpatriotic not to run. I think he sees from his perspective, and you know, you guys are not on the same zone here, but he sees the country needing someone like him, and that not to step into that would be a big mistake. And if you read his book, you know, basically A Promise to My Son, or Promise, you know, about Beau Biden, you sort of see that for him not to run would be a violation of the things that he wrote in that book. So my gut tells me he is going to run. I got to tell you, I was at a party last night with Mike Bloomberg. I'd say the same thing about him. I think Mike Bloomberg's going to run. I think a lot of people are going to run. We were talking about this on the plane. I think the field is going to be so big. And some of the people are going to be big names we know, like Biden, possibly Bloomberg and others. But I think you're going to see a lot of new names. You know, they've been talking to Beto O'Rourke, but I bet there are other names we haven't even heard of that could pop. And it's going to be one of the most fascinating. It'll be like what you guys had in the Republican side. It's going to be a fascinating, you know, kind of paintball game to see who knocks out whom as they percolate this next year.
All right, Steve Clements, who knows Joe Biden very well, predicts Biden and Bloomberg run. I don't think there's any doubt both of them are going to run. And if you're Mayor Bloomberg, why not, right? You got bajillions of dollars.
Here's
what's going to be interesting.
Let's do it again.
Every time. I know we have to, and we will do that. Steve, I'm out of time. What's your Twitter handle?
SC Clemens. Steve. So SCCLEMONS. Happy to chat with anyone.
Joining us now, Fightin' Joe Morrissey from the Fightin' Joe Morrissey Show. Joe, great to have you.
Good morning, John. Good to be back with you.
You know, this is a reversal of roles, Joe, because for a long time, you were the guy in the public eye. You were the guy that people like us were talking to, and we were making news based on what you were doing. Now, Joe, your role has been reversed. Now, you're talking to people that are making the news, and you become the newsmaker on your show, The Fighting Joe Morrissey Show. I wanted to have you on today because I listened to your segment yesterday on former Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling and his job at James Madison University. And I was riveted by it, and you were very critical of the whole thing, and you called for like a bunch of people to resign. Joe, you've served in the General Assembly. You know the rules. You know what goes on there. You've been a House of Delegates member, both as a Democrat and an independent. So you're not beholden to anybody, no political party or anything else. Joe, give our audience a full breakdown on what former Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling did and how this stinks on ice.
Sure, John, I'll be happy to. But let me just underscore what you just said. I take great pride in the show that I compliment Republicans and Democrats equally. I also am critical of them. Yesterday, very critical of the Democratic mayor in the Coliseum, as I was with Bill Bowling. So I truly call it the way I see it. But let me lay the groundwork so that people can understand the Bill Bowling fiasco that exists right now. Bill Bowling served as a member of the Board of Supervisors in Hanover, then 12 years as a state senator, 8 more years as lieutenant governor, all the while piling up Virginia Retirement System, VRS, years. Once you get to 30 years, and he was close to it, then your retirement vests, and you get a nice pension. So here's what happens. Bill Bowling gets appointed to the Board of Visitors at James Madison University. The Board of Visitors is like the board of directors of a corporation. They set policy. They hire the president. They are the president of the university's boss. They are the final buck stops here entity. You are prohibited when you are a member of the Board of Visitors from feathering your own nest, pursuing your own agenda, be it political, financial, etc. And that's important. Your interests are the university's first and foremost and last. So what happens? He's on the Board of Visitors. He is the boss, one of the bosses, of the president of JMU. And while he is serving on the Board of Visitors, he starts communicating with President Alger at JMU, trying to create a position for himself. Alger goes along with it and says, okay, write your own job description. That's right. He told him to write his own job description. So Bowling writes a job description saying that he will be the, you know, senior fellow in residence to discuss civil discourse and politics at JMU. Blah, 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 blah. And then he gives himself a $140,000 a year salary, a house on the campus at a reduced rate, and a signing bonus, which I'll get to later. And they're communicating back and forth, and they're in emails, and then they discuss the political pushback and how to handle it politically. And then Bowling says, I've got to have 3 years, 3 months, then my retirement will vest. And here's where it gets critical. He needs 3 years to get himself up to 30 years, and his retirement will go from $17,000 a year to over almost $70,000 a year if he gets this job. And there's no public posting. There's no search. Nothing. They create this job for him. And through a great deal of investigatory work by Patrick Wilson and others down in the Shenandoah Valley area, this is all uncovered. A FOIA request is done. And Bill Bowling comes out and says, oh, no, I didn't do it for financial reasons. I just love being in that academic environment.
Talk radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM. WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says President Donald Trump has ordered a slowdown to the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Syria. Speaking after lunch Sunday with the president, South Carolina Republican described the slowdown as a pause situation and said, "I think we're slowing things down in a smart way." Graham had criticized the president's announced withdrawal of about 2,000 troops from war-torn Syria. A lion killed a young worker at a wildlife conservatory in North Carolina Sunday after it got loose from a locked space. Alexandra Black was killed Sunday after being attacked by the lion in an enclosure that was being cleaned at the conservator center, that, according to news outlets, citing a statement from the Caswell County Sheriff's Office. The lion was shot and killed after attempts to tranquilize the animal failed. This is SRN News.
Here's your community calendar from WBOB.
Saturday, January 5th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's the Fernandina Beach Marketplace Farmers Market on North 7th Street in Fernandina Beach. Saturday, January 5th at 6 p.m., it's the Hall of Heroes Mini Comic-Con at Mosh at the Museum of Science and History. And Sunday, January 6th at 10 a.m., it's the Orange Park Farmers and Art Market at the Town Hall Park on Park Avenue.
For more information or to have your event included, visit WBOB.com.
WBOB is talk radio. There are a variety of ways to listen to WBOB. Streaming on the internet, on our mobile app, on 101.1 FM, and even on the AM dial. WBOB AM 600 is proud to broadcast all over the southeastern coast, from Georgia to Jacksonville to Orlando. No matter how or where you listen, WBOB is solid, reasoned talk radio.
With all the hustle and bustle of Christmas shopping and party planning, it's sometimes easy to forget what the true meaning of Christmas is. Well, the Boger family at Boger Shoes would like to remind everyone what the Christmas season is all about. Christmas is about the celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ, who was born to Mary and Joseph in a lowly manger in Bethlehem. There were no office parties, no Christmas trees, just the arrival of three kings that brought gifts and knelt beside this manger occupied by the Savior of our world. When you think about Christmas this year, please reflect on why this holiday is so significant. Since 1957, Boger Shoes has been providing orthopedic and diabetic shoes for thousands of customers in Northeast Florida. And Boger Shoes offers free evaluations and fittings by three board-certified podiatrists on staff. Good old-fashioned customer service has been the key to Boger Shoes' success since 1957. So stop by 1014 Park Street in Five Points and experience the Boger's difference. Boger Shoes, the answer for hurting feet. And Merry Christmas from everyone at Boger Shoes.
Does rainy weather make you nervous? Alliant Roofing says that it's time to think about a new roof. Get repairs done or ask about a roof tune-up. Once water seeps into the roof, you have a great chance of costly repairs and mold leading to health issues. Mason Fleming at Alliant Roofing has over 30 years of experience specializing in commercial and residential type roof systems. Call for a free estimate at 237-4700 or 721-7663. Alliant Roofing, Florida State Certified Roofing License CCC 132-8560. Florida State Certified Builder's License CBC 125-7928.
The latest traffic and weather on WBOB, your 2018 election authority.
Joining us now, David Clark, America's Sheriff. You can get more information, americasheriff.com. Sheriff Clark, great to have you.
John, it's a pleasure, and hello once again to your listeners.
Sheriff, Merry Christmas. Where do we start? Let's start at the beginning. Okay, yesterday, Comey, what is up with this guy, right? Goes to lies. We got this dossier thing. Why don't they just admit, look, I took a fake dossier that was funded by Oppo, Clinton Research, DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I took it to a FISA court judge. I lied to him and got him to sign a warrant on an innocent American. You know what he says yesterday, according to the transcript? He says, well, you know, it was first funded by Republicans. No, it was first funded by Republicans opposed to Trump in the nominating process through the neocon publication, the Washington Free Beacon. And Trump was campaigning as a non-interventionist. But doesn't matter where the funding came from. Sheriff was opposition research. I mean, you've had it in your own campaigns, right? People paying for oppo research on Sheriff Clark, what you did. You didn't pay a parking ticket or whatever happened. I mean, but nobody's ever addressed why this went to a FISA court judge and was not explained, right?
Yeah, this is a shame, you know, but the first time on Comey, he's a corrupted individual. He took a glorious institution, the FBI, and took it down into the gutter. Now, the problem here for him, and he knows this, because right now this is CYA for him, okay? He knows that they took that fake dossier, they knew the source of it, and they tried to drag it into the United States Department of Justice and started a criminal investigation on a fake dossier. So what he did was he dragged politics in to the United States Department of Justice. Shame on him. He knows exactly what went on. When you're the director of the FBI, look, I was the sheriff of Milwaukee County. I was in law enforcement for 40 years. I had bosses in the Milwaukee Police Department when I was there, and I was the boss as the sheriff. None of that stuff happens without your knowledge. And I don't mean every little thing that goes on, but major stuff like that has to go up to the top before people act on it. That's where the McCabes and the Strucks and the Page come in. Those were high-ranking level people who would have to keep Comey informed because they are kibitzing in a general election for the president of the United States, for heaven's sakes. For him to imply that people were involved in that in some investigatory capacity without his knowledge is a straight-up lie.
So, for the life of me, Sheriff, I mean, what has troubled me about this at the beginning is I really do believe in the sanctity of the judges. And the FISA court judges are secret judges. They're not in public for that reason, right? Because we want to keep them secret. They revolve, but these are judges in the United States judicial system. And if you don't believe in the sanctity of judges' decisions, our whole system crumbles. I mean, it's as simple as that. So, but why hasn't the president allowed the redacted transcript of what was presented to those FISA court judges in signing this warrant? Because if they didn't make it absolutely clear to that signing judge that this eavesdropping warrant on a U.S. citizen, the only evidence they had was paid oppo research by first the Washington Free Beacon, anti-Trump at the time, then Debbie Wasserman Schultz, then Clinton campaign. I mean, why not just send that out and let the American public decide for themselves?
Well, I think eventually he will. That's a tactical move. That's the political side. It's got to be a tactical political move on his part. And what he wants to do, I believe, is he wants to let the Mueller investigation play all of its hand, put all of its cards on the table, take their best shot, and then, because it's not going to lead to any sort of indictment by the President of the United States anyway, then come out and lay your cards down and expose this thing for what it is. If he plays that card too early, John, with the news cycles that we have and the fact that the lying liberal media is going to dismiss it anyway, the redacted copies, then all of a sudden that's gone out of the news cycle and you allow Mueller to continue this witch hunt. So he's biding his time, I believe, and at some point we're going to see those unredacted reports.
Well, that is sober analysis, Sheriff Clark. That's why we have you on, because you're America's sheriff. You can go to americasheriff.com, read more about Sheriff David Clark, who's with us now on the John Fredericks Radio Network. Sheriff Clark, we got a shutdown looming on Friday. This is a PR disaster for the president. They made a counter over to Schumer. He turned it down. He has no reason to negotiate. He wants to shut the government down before Christmas. And we'll have 1,000 people coming up on CNN saying how they can't buy presents for their children. How do you solve this?
Well, there's two different situations going on here, as you know, and you know I've talked about. There's the political side, and then there's the policy side. The president sat down with Schumer and Pelosi, and he was talking the policy side. He was talking about protecting the sovereignty of the United States. He was talking about the protection of the United States from a security point, in terms of the stuff that's coming in through that porous southern border. And Schumer and Pelosi, on the other hand, were talking about the politics. They came in there armed with and waving this government shutdown in front of them. And usually when you do that in front of a Republican, your standard politician, political Republican, they run like their hair's on fire from a government shutdown because, oh, we're going to get blamed for it. Oh, it's going to be a political disaster. The president took that off the table by saying, I'm not afraid of that. If it comes to that, I will do it. However, he knows he's got his other options. And from the policy perspective, he wants that wall continued. Some of it has already been started, but he needs more funding to complete the task. And even the $5 billion he asked for out of the approximately $25 billion that he thinks he needs, that is just one-fifth of what he needs. That's reasonable. That's how you start negotiations. You put things on the table, and then you have to say to yourself, what do I want out of this? What do I not want? He wants that wall built. He knows he can go to the Defense Department and get the $5 billion if he needs it, but he needs to let Schumer and Pelosi know that they're not going to go to that old bag of tricks with this fear of a government shutdown to get it done. So I don't think he's going to blink, to be honest with you. But again, I'm not advising him. I'm not in his head. But I watch this stuff astutely from a tactical and strategic approach toward these things because that's what they are. So I'm telling everybody on our side, when I say our side, let me be clear, people on the right, conservatives, some Republicans, not all, but I'm telling them, take a deep breath, take a step back. This man knows what he's doing, and he's going to win on this. Somehow that wall is going to get built, to heck with whether the government gets shut down or not, and then the president knows that. You know, it may come to that. I still think it's going to come to that. But also what he did was in having Sarah Huckabee Sanders float that yesterday that they may find some other way to get it done, that carried the news cycle. So now all of a sudden the president comes off as, hey, seems reasonable. He didn't draw a red line. He's backing off. He wants to negotiate, so on and so forth, turn what you want. But that ran the news cycle compared to the last news cycle when he had the meeting. It was Trump shutdown. Trump's going to shut the government down. So now he's got the Democrats trying to guess what he's going to do, and that's what you want your opposition to do in a political fight. You want to keep them off balance.
Why aren't you in there advising him? You'd be good. That's good advice, man.
I'll tell you what, he didn't become a billionaire by taking advice from me, but I watch this stuff because I have a keen interest in it. Like I said, from a strategic viewpoint and position, not so much the political.
Sheriff David Clark, you can go to americasheriff.com. Got a couple more minutes. Sheriff Clark, let's get to the justice reform bill. Full disclosure, full disclaimer here. I have been in favor of justice reform as a Republican for a very long time. I didn't like three strikes, you're out. I don't like all of these mandatory sentences. The fact that we have the highest recidivism rate in the free world by 2.5 to 1. We have the highest number of people incarcerated in federal penitentiaries as a percentage of population by 2 to 1, bigger than China or Cuba, that have political prisons. I mean, it's horrific, the system we have. And a lot of these driven by the lobbyists because, as you know, Sheriff, we've got private profit-making federal penitentiaries on the stock exchange. They make money by filling up the beds and getting more prisoners in. What did you think of the bill that passed the Senate last night?
There were some things in it that I did not like, straight up. And one of the things I didn't like is they made it retroactive to people who've already had their due process. They were convicted in a court of law. They were serving out a sentence. They were probably serving a shorter sentence than they were exposed to in the original charge before the plea bargain, and I just didn't like that aspect. If you want to move forward and you want to recalibrate some of those things, I'm all for that. So that's why I think, you know, it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but there were some things I didn't like. But let me say this about the number of people we have incarcerated in the United States. We also have more freedoms in the United States than they have in China or Cuba. And they don't put up with that nonsense in terms of criminal activity. They make it very clear, and that's why the people that live in those countries, they get it, and I'm not praising those countries. They know if I commit a robbery, if I commit a burglary, if I commit a murder, that's the end. That's it. You don't have this long drawn out with all these rights and all these lawyers protecting you. And guess what? After a while, people realize, and this is what we don't do in the United States, people realize, and that's a deterrent. They go, the government's not going to put up with my nonsense as it relates to crime. That's why we have so many people locked up because we have so many freedoms and we tolerate this crap. And then what happens is it actually encourages people to keep engaging in that behavior because the government didn't do too much the last time. So, you know, that's why I think, you know, if you want to talk some of the policy, three strikes out, okay, yeah, does that need to be recalibrated? Sure. But in the end, these people all got due process, okay? And they were all convicted or pled guilty or something in a court of law. And so they had their swing, you know, they had their chance with it. And they also knew this isn't their first time that day. You don't go to prison unless you commit murder or sexual assault of a child or something like that. You don't go to prison the first time you commit a crime. You commit a robbery or burglary, you're not going to go to prison. You're probably going to get probation. So there was a lot of myths and propaganda about that from the criminal advocates. And there wasn't enough from the victim advocate sides. They weren't on board with it. And I'm always going to side with the victims of crime, not the perpetrators of crime.
That's why I love having you on. We don't agree on that, but it's always great to get your perspective. But I believe, Sheriff, in the 80% rule. We agree on 80% of the stuff, therefore we're bosom brothers. John Frederick's Radio Network. Hey, get more information. Go to americasheriff.com. Sheriff David Clark, also Senior Policy Advisor for America First Policies. John Frederick's Radio Network, good to have you back. Bob McDonald finally joining us now. The last Republican to win statewide so far since Bob McDonald 2009. Democrats have won, I don't know, 20 in a row, something like that, 13. There's no more Republican Party of Virginia. It's a beeper, an answering machine, and I don't know, maybe a postal permit. And it's a complete disaster. McDonald winning a stunning victory in 2009, getting, I think, over 60%, got 100% of the vote on Tangier Island with 200 for 200, and carried Fairfax by, I think, under 100 votes or something. Very, very, very close. And he's joining us now. Bob McDonald, Governor, great to have you, man.
Hey, John, thanks. Appreciate it. I've been on in a while, and good to talk to your listeners.
Merry Christmas to you, your family.
Thank
Hope you're
you,
doing
John.
Well.
Same to you. I'm glad we can still say that. Merry Christmas.
I know. It's so great. And happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah to all of our listeners out there. Bob, we got a lot to talk about here in about 15 minutes, but I want to get to some of the analogies here between all these Trump investigations. Michael Flynn yesterday going bankrupt, basically saying that he had to plead out because he just couldn't pay lawyers. You kind of went through the same thing. Government go after you, right, Governor? They got unlimited resources. You were able to fight it and hang in there and eventually get exonerated by the Supreme Court of the United States. Is there an analogy here, Governor?
You know, we have the best criminal justice system in the world. We got tremendous people in public service, both in uniform and on the lawyers. But, you know, they're not perfect. And sometimes they get it wrong. I thought in my case, after, you know, $28 million on a theory that had never been used before in legal circles and 8.5 investigators for a couple of years, you know, they were unanimously wrong by the Supreme Court. And the opinion and the language of the justices from the bench said as much. And so there are times that that perhaps other motives get involved for why prosecutions are brought. But, you know, I think in the political context, we've got a tone, John, of vitriol and hyperpartisanship and you know, sort of an ugliness on both sides of the equation that's really toxic for our country. I mean, we need to restore civility and not, you know, we've got government by litigation and investigation. You know, it's supposed to be government by legislation. And so I think there's a lot of reflection both sides of the aisle need to do about how what kind of tone and what kind of spirit of cooperation are they bringing to the table. And it does spill over into the criminal justice system. I was delighted to see some reforms yesterday that I think would have positive for the country in the prison context. But, you know, there's more to do. But overall, you know, you got good people in our criminal justice system. We just have to recruit people that are going to call balls and strikes and not inject other motives into the system.
Governor McDonald, let's get to Virginia. You won a stunning victory in 2009 on the platform Bob for Jobs. You carried Fairfax. It's almost unthinkable now that a Republican would ever carry Fairfax. You actually carried it. I remember one other thing about it. I mentioned earlier you carried Tangier Island, I think 200 for 200, 100%.
And no, I actually lost four votes there, John. I think it was only 99%.
Oh, 90, is it 196 to 4, right? But listen, Governor, I mean, since then, and that was just a stunning victory, since then, there's no Republican Party now in Virginia to speak of. They've lost, I don't know, 13 statewide races in a row. Kirk Cox is the firewall. If he loses, they can't raise a dime. Thing is over. I mean, having been the last person to actually engineer a stunning coalition of victory, what do Republicans in Virginia, Governor McDonnell, have to do to maybe have a chance at getting a statewide victory again and rebuilding the party?
You know, you've issued a clarion warning. I don't think it's quite that stark, but it could be in the very near future for a lot of reasons, demographics and some other things. So I guess, John, I spoke at the Republican Advance this weekend and kind of outlined a little bit of a strategy for how to do that. Listen, I was very, very blessed in 2009. We had great running mates. We had incredible enthusiasm. And, John, you know the curse, too, is part of it, and that is that the party in power in Washington and the presidency loses the governor's race in Virginia for every year for the last 48, except for the Cuccinelli-McAuliffe race. Mm-hmm. That has held true. People look at Washington and say, we don't like what's happening there, and we don't want that in Virginia. I mean, it's a constant phenomenon. So with the President Obama in the White House, I certainly had some advantages. But here's a couple things, John, that I've outlined for people. One, you know, we need candidates that are happy warriors. Conservatives are always maligned by the other side untruthfully as the party that doesn't like women, that doesn't take care of children and all these other things that are nonsense, but they sell it. The media supports it. And so we need people. Our tone has got to be much better. The happy warrior, confident in what we believe in. And secondly, explaining why conservatism works, that lower, less government, lower taxes, a good safety net, an entrepreneurial code of statutes and regulations, why that's better for the United States people of all stripes, colors, races, and creeds, and frankly, why socialism has failed everywhere it's been tried in the planet. If you look at the messages of the National Democrats today, that's exactly where they are, and it's never worked as an economic theory. Thirdly, I think we need to not always nominate the most electable conservative candidate. We've nominated some people, that just because of their tone and some of their baggage and some of their previous policies is just way out of line with where Virginians are. If the independents, John, is still control, Republicans and Democrats generally will vote for their party candidate, but 37-38% and an increasing number of people say they're independents. That's where elections are won and lost. Most people don't have faith that either one of the major political parties can solve the problems of the day at the federal level, and so it spills down. Millennials over 50% now say they're independents, and we have to have a message to them. And I guess the final couple things that I would say, John, is we are projected to be a majority non-white nation in about 27 years, and the way that we message, the way we talk, the way we outreach to people of color is just not good. And we have to explain why our philosophy, which is not more free stuff and not more giveaways and not more government regulations to tilt the playing field for business and people generally, why that's not a winning strategy, but conservatism, which is making it lifting up all boats and giving everyone an opportunity to achieve the American dream, why that works better. And then there's other things. Obviously, we've got to do some party restructuring. Our voter registration efforts is not nearly as good in suburbia and other places as the Democrats have done. And so, it's myriad things, John, not one particular thing, but I am optimistic that a message of economic liberty and political liberty and religious liberty and more access to the American dream still is, for 240 years, that's what our country stood for, and that's what we need to be talking about.
We're with Governor Bob McDonnell, former governor of Virginia, Republican governor, exonerated by the Supreme Court unanimously. I think it was 8-0. Was it 8-9? I don't remember.
Well, it was 8. Unfortunately, Justice Scalia had passed away a few months before the decision.
8-0. And also the liberals delivered a blistering assessment of what went down here. So the governor completely exonerated. I want to get to a couple things before I get to the party and your future. Number one, you said that Republicans in Virginia are not doing a good job of messaging to non-white people who will be the majority in a 27-year period. Give me an example of that, Governor.
Well, for instance, I think that the tone of the way we talk and look, the tone in Washington is horrible in both parties. You know, I like a lot of what President Trump is doing, but the name calling, the tweets that sometimes aren't accurate. I mean, and the tone of which he talks to people sometimes is just not one that's going to ingratiate people to our cause. So I think, again, we got to be the happy word. Secondly, you have to actually go and talk to people. There have been elections that I've seen where people just are focusing on, you know, the base, and that's a losing strategy. I mean, we have to realize that it is an increasingly beautifully diverse Virginia and America. And you know, one little thing that I did, you know, when I was governor, we had like 35 different bumper stickers. We had one for every college. We had one in every one of the languages spoken in Virginia, and just little things like that said that we cared about those constituencies, but particularly, you know, in the African American community, more economic opportunity, more ways to help minority businesses get capital, more of a level playing field with state procurement, and things of that nature are ones that begin to make a difference. So my last year as governor, we did a couple things with prisoner reentry, with the restoration of rights, where we were able to build some great coalitions you know, across the political and racial lines in order to get some positive things done. And so there are myriad opportunities, John, to be able to do that. But when you look at the changing demography of America, we have to realize that we can't continue just to talk to the same echo chamber.
Well, David Ramanan tweets in and says that one example of what my question just was chain migration and ending that, which is one of the mainstays of President Trump's immigration reform. Ramanan says that's an example of where the messaging to non-white people might be off track with Republicans. Got a couple more minutes. We're going to get to your future in a second. Party restructuring. When you were there, you had, I believe, David Rexrode was the executive director, and Garen Shipley was your spokesperson. You were building an organization, but look, you were able to raise money. I mean, now they can't raise any money for the party. Bill Howe wouldn't give them a dime. They can't raise any money. The Democrats have 20, 25 full-time people. They've got three. There is no structure. We have two more questions. One is about rebuilding the party with no money. To compete with the Democratic Party of Virginia machine that McAuliffe's constructed, what would be your vision for being able to do that?
Well, obviously, people invest in things that are credible. And I think our new chairman, Jack Wilson, who I met with a little bit of this weekend, has got some very good ideas. People seem this weekend to want to win again, and were very receptive to some, you know, very direct internal critiques of what we needed to build. But listen, the people that have been traditional donors to me or to Mark Early or Jerry Kilgore or Jim Gilmore, George Allen, they're still interested in investing and winning because they believe in the conservative ideas and the philosophy of government. So it really comes down to the matter of credibility, and I think this new chairman is.